Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this latest in the LSE's public lecture series. And for once, I think a very brief introduction is in order, since I am very conscious that in the LSE community, Fred Halliday is much better known than I am, and therefore there's not a lot of point in my introducing him to you. Fred's been at the school for more than 20 years as a professor of international relations here. He is also, in his spare time, a member of the Advisory Council of the Labour Party's Foreign Policy Centre. And given the rapidity and frequency of departures from Downing Street these days, he may soon be the only advisor left to the Labour Party. He also has a book forthcoming through Cambridge University Press, Politics, Power and International Relations in the Middle East, and that will be out in November, so sadly there aren't copies on sale afterwards, but I'm sure you can already order it on Amazon. Fred is going to talk about the Middle East after Saddam Hussein, a simple topic. He thinks he can probably keep his remarks down below 3 hours this evening, but we'll have some time for questions afterwards, so without more ado, over to you, Fred.
Thank you very much, Howard. Ladies and gentlemen, let me begin by welcoming you all to this lecture. In particular, I'd like to welcome our visitors and friends from the Middle East who are here. We have at LSE, as you know, students from over 150 countries, but a very vibrant community from the Arab world, from Israel, from Turkey, from Iran. And I'm glad to say that in more than 20 years of teaching the Middle East, we've never had a serious conflict, except once between two groups of Lebanese, who for some reason fell out. We have in particular a group of friends from Iraq today, who I hope we will listen to and hear from, and also a special group of friends from Kuwait, who have more reason than most of us for knowing about the charitable intentions of Saddam Hussein. I think we are all aware that in these days and these weeks, we're living here in Europe in a very contradictory time. And I think this contradiction is worth examining and should be on our minds. Because on the one hand, it is a time of fear and disarray. We are, in a sense, which I would not want to overstate or understate, at war. Mr. Bin Laden's ultimatum runs out in mid-July, in good time for the summer holidays and for the Greek Olympics. And at the same time, we have just witnessed an extraordinary event, suitably taken place in the capital of European civilization, the city of my birth, Dublin, which is the unification of the 25 states, which is an occasion, I think, for hope and for pride, not much celebrated in this bit of the British Isles, but that's the problem of the people who live here, most of whom were originally illegal immigrants, I hasten to point out, but one which I think holds out great promise and not irrelevant to the other side of the story. Because if you ask the question, why did the West prevail in the Cold War, it wasn't, in my view, so much because of missiles or threats, it was because of the example of a prosperous and democratic society, which for all its failures was superior to that which people in the East saw. And if in the long run we are going to have better and more stable relations, not just with the Middle East and the Muslim world, but with the third world as a whole, that's the 4 or 5 billion people who are not part of the prosperous West, and then I think we have to live up to our best traditions as well, in levels of democracy, in levels of economics, but also in levels of equality between people of different races, and not least in protection of civil rights. I was at a conference in Paris on Monday, organized by the European Union, by Javier Solana's office, on the Middle East and the European Union. The French presiding officer, a redoubtable lady called Nicole Gnassotto, banged the table at 9 o'clock and said, she said, this, after 1,000 years of war and conflict, is the first working day of the new Europe. And she welcomed the guests, and not guests, now permanent members from the Eastern European countries. On the one hand, they were joining a union which is, as I say, in some sense at war. But on the other hand, they brought their own particular experience, and I was struck by this in two particular ways. One is that by dint of their own academic traditions and by dint of the linguistic and scholastic traditions with communism in its own way fostered, they have a very large number of scholars competent in the Middle East, in the language, the history, the politics, some of whom participated in the discussion. But the other thing they brought, and it's hard for us in Western Europe to remember this, is their own particular relations to the Middle East and the Muslim world. I don't just think of Cyprus and Malta, who were formed in conflict with the Ottoman Empire, but I think of other countries in Eastern Europe which had historically very good relations with the Middle East, not least because they had a common enemy in Russia. Poland and the Ottoman Empire enjoyed very good relations in the 17th and 18th centuries for that reason. And when Poland disappeared at the end of the 18th century, partitioned between Germany and Prussia, this was a great setback for Turkey. And in a beautiful act of symbolism, throughout the 19th century, when the diplomatic corps were brought to the Ottoman Sultan's palace and lined up, and they tried to introduce the ambassadors to the Sultan, he would always bang his staff on the floor and say, "Please tell me, where is the envoy of my dear friend, His Majesty, the King of Poland?" And I like this story very much, not least because the Polish Prime Minister is here on an official visit to the Polish President, but also because it goes to the heart of the nonsense we hear about the inevitable and eternal clash between Western and Eastern civilizations, when in fact the story of state relations, economic relations, trading relations is much more varied. And you can see that in language. The main square in this city has an Arab name, Trafalgar. One of the main football teams in this city has an Arab name, Dar es Sana'a, Arsenal. The main artistic center in this city, the Barbican, is a Persian word, Bab Khane. I don't attach too much importance to this, but I think the history of interaction, of trade, of borrowing, also of conflict, is much more varied, as it will be in the future. And our Eastern European new arrivals, I think, underline that for us. How do we look at the crisis in which we now find ourselves and the varied dimensions of it? Well, one way of grappling with it, which I hope is not too abstract and pedagogic, is to take the famous distinction of the French historian Fernand Braudel, founder of the Annales School, into three different kinds of time, three different kinds of historical time, familiar, I'm sure, to most of you. There is the long durée, the long period of many decades and centuries, which is the time of ecological change, of massive demographic change, of the rise of national and social consciousness. Then there is the intermediate period, the conjunctural, that of decades and of generations, perhaps the Cold War, or the 70 years of European colonialism would count in that way. And then there is the more immediate, the time of events, immediate occurrences, les événements in French, and from which we get the adjective which has no English equivalent, événementiel, events-based. This is, by the way, a term of abuse in French intellectual circles. I once had a French student doing our MSc IR theory course, of which we're rather proud, and we like to think we lift people out of the contemporary and the immediate, but she was having none of it. I said to her in November, after about 6 weeks, "What do you think of our theory course?" "C'est très événementiel," she said, "very superficial, events-based." And what she really meant was that we were trying to illustrate these abstract theoretical points with some particular examples which she didn't like. Now, if we turn to the current situation we find ourselves in, I think one can say that the challenges and issues we face fall into each of these three time frames. There is the immediate crisis in Iraq, which I shall talk about, but also the explosions and burning crises in the broader Middle East, be they in Palestine, in the Sudan, in Cyprus, or in Afghanistan. These are the événementiel. Then there is the threat of fundamentalist terrorism. Far from being the only terrorism in the world, but the one that threatens us the most and is out to kill all or nearly everybody in this room, and we should have no doubt about it, and certainly not a friend to the values of the LSE. This was evident before the 11th of September and well before the 11th of March, but it falls into the realm of the conjunctural, something that will go on, has gone on for, I think, at least two and a half decades and will go on for many more. And then we come to the longue durée, the one that is perhaps most worrying, most complex, and that is relations between the West and the Muslim world. A subpart, I would suggest, of something broader, which arises out of the whole experience of the forging of the world economy over recent centuries and out of the experience of colonialism, which is that of the divide between the rich West and the whole of Asia, Africa, and Latin America as a whole, clearly taking a particular form in the Muslim world, but by no means confined to it, as the enormous popularity of bin Laden in China, in India, in Brazil, bears out. And I think we have to try and separate out, but recognize the interconnections between these three problems, these three challenges, and the three timescales. That of the immediate Middle East events, that of the issue of terrorism, which is going to be with us for a long time to come, and let us please not underestimate them, and thirdly, the much broader issue of intercultural and interethnic relations. I do think that the issue of cultural and interethnic relations between Western Europe in its Christian form and the Muslim world is the dominant political and economic challenge of the 21st century. And I have to say it's a subject in which an enormous amount of misleading and pernicious things are written and said. And in recent months, we have seen some very disturbing statements by people who are, for better or worse, in positions of public authority in this country, noticeably Mr. Kilroy Silk, alumnus of this school, I regret to say, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, among others. And what is striking and disturbing to me is not just what they have said, but the fact that they have not been contradicted or rebuked by our political and media leaders. They have in many ways been indulged, and, let us be clear, the more we know, they have received the overwhelming support of most people in this country. Let me turn to Iraq. Everything that we are discussing about Iraq, as the title of this lecture shows, is in the shadow of one man, powerful, cruel, and in his political aspirations, demented as he was. So we may, with some bitterness, recall his words of a little while ago. "You may remove me as president," he said, "but if you do, you'll need at least 7 presidents to hold this country down." A rough Arabic translation, I suspect, of the famous words of Louis XIV, "Après moi le déluge." The focus of this lecture is, and in my view should be, Iraq. Its people, its recent history, its sufferings, and its future. Too much of our Western discussion ignores or paraphrases this dimension, as we are taken up with legitimate, but in my view secondary, internal and legal disputes, which are conducted with scant attention to the fate and to the views of the 25 million people most directly concerned, and is also conducted in seeming ignorance of the ways in which we in this country and throughout the West, as well as in the Soviet Union, supported and sustained that regime for 3.5 decades. I had a visit recently from 2 Iraqi colleagues who've toughed it out all those years. They came into my office, and before we'd sat down, one of them said, "You bastards, you supported this man for 35 years. Why did you wait 35 years to get rid of him?" And I think that's a feeling very widely held by many Iraqis. So whatever our own views may be, I think this should be our starting point, not the debates and inquiries and tergiversations and half-truths and cover-ups of London, Washington, Paris, and I may say Madrid. I'm not here claiming to have an answer to all these questions, and I can't see the future of Iraq, except to say that events are moving very quickly. I've never seen a political situation in its national and international dimensions move so quickly. And my own gut feeling is we have a very short time, probably less than a month, to come up with a new policy and a new solution. And if we fail to do so, and this is certainly a view widely held in the Arab world, then an earthquake will start which could last for years and decades with enormous consequences, not just for the region, but for migration, for international security, and not least, of course, for the small matter of the price of oil, which is already generally held to be too high at over $30 a barrel. I have 2 particular observations, personal observations, to make about Iraq. One is that in my own study of the Arab world and engagement with it over more than 30 years, most of what I've learned from Iraqis. Whether it was at SOAS, Dr. Kelidar, whether it was here, Professor Ali Kaduri, who was a dominant figure in the politics and government department for many years, as well as a ferocious opponent of nationalism, much to his credit. Whether it is the Sheikh of all studies of the Middle East in London now, Professor Sami Zubeda of Birkbeck, who gave his inaugural lecture last night. Whether it's the younger generation of scholars like Kanan Makia, Fali Abdel Jabbar, Issam al-Khafaji, and many others, they have set an intellectual tone and a tone of engagement with their country which is greater than that of any other group of Middle Eastern intellectuals with their own country. My other observation is just derived from the one visit I made there in 1980 to lecture at the College of Law and Politics in Baghdad, soon afterwards renamed the Saddam Hussein College of Law and Politics. It was a very tense time. Saddam had just eliminated his party rivals, including, as he thought he should, shooting a lot of people who'd been in jail several years for conspiracy. And all party members had been commanded, including students in this country, to watch the video of the execution. They had increasing pressure from Iran, and there were gunfights and battles in Baghdad at that time. And something hard to remember, but very much on their mind, because this was only 4 months after the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, they had the belief that the Soviet Union might well invade using the 20-year Treaty of Friendship, which they had used to justify their invasion of Afghanistan. And if you look at the map, you will see that from Soviet bases in the Caucasus to Baghdad is not much further, or not even as far as from Soviet bases in Central Asia to Kabul. I remember in particular meeting the head of the political science department, who greeted me in his office quite relaxedly, and he said, "Welcome to Iraq," he said. "You know, when I opened the papers in the morning, I don't know if I've been appointed ambassador to the UN or sentenced to death, and in either case, but I know why." This then is Iraq. I think we should remember what, in 35 years, the Ba'athist government did. It wrecked the best endowed of all Arab countries in terms of its intelligentsia, in terms of its agriculture, in terms of its oil, in terms of its broader factor and in demographic endowment. It killed hundreds and thousands of its own people, Arab and Kurd. It deported millions from their homes in forced resettlement programs, the cost of which is now an explosive issue in Iraq. It gassed the Kurdish population in the north, not just once, but over a long period of time. It destroyed the society of the Marsh Arabs in the south. It forced millions of Iraqis into exile, including in this country. It attacked Iran in 1980 and Kuwait in 1990 and plunged the country into these two catastrophic wars. And finally, when the Iraqi people, in a dramatic demonstration of their own patriotism, for such it was, rose up in 1991 after the defeat in Kuwait, Saddam crushed them. This, in addition to the murdering of opponents abroad and also of moderate Palestinian leaders, including my dear friend Said Hamami, the PLO representative, who was shot in his office here in Mayfair in 1978 for urging discussions with members of Knesset, as he thought is his duty to do. The systematic bribing of foreign diplomats, journalists, academics, and intellectuals, which stretched well into Europe and Latin America, as well into the Middle East. I have here the famous document of the Kupunat Saddam, the Saddam's coupons, the list of people throughout the world, including this country, who received bribes from Saddam in the form of evasions of the oil for food program. I'm not going to read it out, A, because it's a long list, and B, I don't want to land up in the libel court, but the list is here, and it strikes me as eminently plausible, I have to say. This, however, pales before the fact which should be our greatest concern, which is this, that for many years, the Ba'athist regime in Iraq benefited from the support and indulgence of the West, not just of the Soviet Union, which most certainly did, but of Britain, France, and the USA. We know from a statement from King Hussein of Jordan that in the original Ba'athist coup of 1963, when several thousand communists and nationalists were killed in a few days, there was active close cooperation between the murderers of the Ba'ath Party and the US intelligence services. We also know, because I know someone who shared a flat with him at the time, but during his time as a student in Cairo in the late 50s, Saddam visited the U.S. Embassy on several occasions and received money from them. After the second decisive coup of 1968, the Ba'ath came to depend more on the Soviet Union. But with the Iranian Revolution of 1979, when the Iranians foolishly and cruelly detained 53 American diplomats in the Tehran Embassy, or as they called it, the Jasus Khane, the spy house, Iraq reestablished close relations with Washington. And it was during the eight-year war with Iran that followed its illegal assault in September 1980, supported and encouraged by the West. During that war, and especially after the Iraqi setbacks of July 1982, it was the West and the Soviet Union which armed that regime, killing a million Iranians in the process. Who is responsible? Margaret Thatcher, Michael Heseltine, Defense Minister Clark, François Mitterrand, Jacques Chirac, Jean-Pierre Chevènement, François Iceberg, Claude Cheysson, Ronald Reagan, Robert Dole, Donald Rumsfeld, the last visitor to see Saddam in 1983, are some of the many names on this list. I would also say that amidst all the debate on the, in my view, rather questionable Spanish withdrawal from Iraq, it might be worth looking at how Spanish companies and indeed political parties conducted relations with Baghdad in the 1980s and 1990s. The same goes, obviously, for many Arab rulers, including the rulers of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. They all got upset when he invaded in 1990. But as with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, they had, in some degree, helped to create and sustain this monster who now leapt from the sorcerer's kitchen to pursue his own campaigns. My conclusion is that beyond our obligations as members of the UN to the preservation of international peace and security, and beyond the claims of elementary human rights concern, we have in the West, and in Britain in particular, as well as in the Arab world and Russia, a deep debt to the people of Iraq, which we ought to repay. How we do it is another matter. Let me now turn to the overall situation, first international, but more importantly regional, with regard to the current situation in the region. And to ask a very elementary question, which may be a bit harsh, but I think is worth posing: who have been the winners and who have been the losers 1 year after the the Western invasion of Iraq. There is no doubt, and this has not been adequately recognized in the West, as to who thinks that they have won in the current climate. Undoubtedly, in the first place, it is the country which has for 3,000 years had a hegemonic political and strategic relationship with Iraq, which commands some cultural, if not political, respect from 60% of the Iraqi population, and has fought two, not one, but two interstate wars with Iraq in recent decades, in which the last of which it lost over 1 million people, and that is Iran. I have met in the past fortnight with two Iranian delegations in London, one from the Foreign Ministry and one from Islamic Media. They are, to put it mildly, most encouraged, not to say delighted, by what has happened and is happening in Iraq. The USA has destroyed their archenemy, as they did the Taliban in Afghanistan to the east. Their own political allies in Iraq, among them the Kurds and the Shiites, have never been stronger and are integrated not only into the new government structure, but into the very US system of administration and indeed intelligence. The US credibility in the region as a whole has never been more severely weakened, and of course Mr. Sharon has helped enormously in this, and the Iranians feel they are now positioned to play a major, if not decisive, role in the formation of any new Iraqi political and social system. According to one Arab diplomat I met in Paris on Monday, Iran is the real occupying power in Iraq, not the Americans at all. They are providing weapons. They have their own armed people, not their militias, their own armed people in some of the Iraqi cities. And whichever way it goes, they think it's going their way. Iran does not, at the moment, want to see the breakup of Iraq, but it would not be unhappy to see the USA bogged down at considerable costs over months of years, and it claims to be delighted, in my view foolishly, that for the first time in modern Arab politics, a Shiite community, which Shiites are one-tenth of all Muslims, but a majority in Iraq, and 80% of Iran, has a required public, legitimate, and internationally recognized status. Some of this I ascribe to the phenomenon of Iranian nationalism, which, as I observed when I was last in Tehran in the year 2000, is very much on the up. In his later years, Imam Khomeini appeared to what he termed the great nation of Iran, In Melate Bozorgi Iran, a revolutionary phrase which, as the historians among you will remember, is ambiguous, deliberately so, as to in what the greatness of the nation consists. Is it the greatness of the revolution? Is it the international influence? Is it the extent of political and cultural hegemony? And was first used in the French Revolution in the famous phrase, equally ambiguous, of La Grande Nation. This was the slogan under which, it is recalled, the Girondins exported revolution in the early 1790s, and Napoleon subjugated much of Europe, but unfortunately, in my view, he didn't succeed in Ireland, but that's another story. This Iranian policy is, in my view, short-sighted for three reasons. First of all, they modeled themselves, as they think, on the Chinese, but they've forgotten the fact that the Chinese have sorted out their economy, at least for the moment, and they most certainly have not. Secondly, while the United States and Israel are not going to invade and occupy Iran, they're quite capable of bombing it, and they're quite capable, and I think indeed quite determined, if Mr. Bolton is to be believed, of taking Iran's non-compliance with the International Atomic Energy Authority to the UN Security Council with the rapid imposition of mandatory sanctions, which, as we know, are quite hard to get off. And thirdly, they are playing with fire with the Sunni-Shia divide. This, as I noticed on a recent visit to the Gulf, to Bahrain and Qatar, is becoming a much more tense issue. And of course, it was greatly fueled by not only the Iranian Revolution, but by the war in Afghanistan, in which the Taliban were perceived as being, and were, Sunni radicals who were dedicated to opposing Shiites. We are at LSE great students of nationalism and the revival and reformulation of the atavistic, and it's a game we can all play. I was slightly shocked, but I told Anthony Smith this story because I knew he'd like it. We had a meeting of Iraqis a few weeks ago, and when I said to them, "How are the Iraqis?" they said, "We're not Iraqis, we're Sumerians." And I thought, what next? But in Afghanistan, if you ask Pashtuns who is their great hero, they will dismiss all the heroes of modern Afghanistan, even the people who founded the state in the 18th century, and they will say Sultan Mahmud. Now, Sultan Mahmud was a 9th century or 10th century ruler in the remote town of Ghazni, and he is famous for massacring Hindus and massacring Shiites. And talking recently to a very intrepid BBC journalist, Kate Clark, who had been to his tomb in the time of the Taliban, she told me that young recruits to the Taliban army were brought to the tomb of Sultan Mahmud and told Sultan Mahmud was a great Muslim hero who had been killing communists even in the days of the Prophet. Now, there's a number of things. The word mushrikeen, meaning a polytheist, is also the same as the root for socialism in Arabic, ishtirakiya. So those who share and are confused. So I can see how mushrikeen became communists and a couple of centuries moving Sultan Mahmud. But that, these young fanatical fighters, aided and abetted, of course, by bin Laden, who was a great one for killing Shiites, is a great one for killing Shiites, and encourages it in Pakistan and here, that this should become the symbol of the fight against the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan was somewhat extraordinary. The second country that can, if more quietly, claim to be a beneficiary of this crisis to date is Turkey. We know why Turkey matters strategically. It matters also because the fate of Turkey and the resolution over decades of the goals of the 1908 Turkish Revolution, which is nearly 100 years old, the role of religion in society, the place of women, the power of the state, the relationship to Europe, all these questions, only if Turkey resolves those questions, the agenda of 1908 and of 1923, the Kemalist Revolution, will the other countries of the Muslim world have a model to look to. So it's not just for Turkey's sake, it's for the sake of this whole long-dure issue that the outcome of what happens in Turkey was, and in my view, is decisive for the broader issue. And for that reason alone, we should welcome them into a Europe of which they have been a part as long as most other nations in Europe, if not even longer. But the Turks are at the moment preoccupied with Cyprus and with the European issue, but Turkey is determined to prevent the emergence of a Kurdish state in Iraq, and it has stationed 5,000 troops in northern Iraq, with the acceptance of the Americans, who are actively building up a protective zone between the Kurdish and Arab areas based on the community of Turkomans. Now, the Turkomans are a Turkish-speaking people, of this there is no doubt, and indeed they're related to the former Soviet Republic of Turkmenistan. The question is, how many of them are there? Some people say 500,000, some people say 3 million, nobody knows, but of course the Turkish army is there, that's what matters. And they don't care what happens in the rest of Iraq, but they do care what happens in the north, and they have emplaced themselves. And if, as I have reason to think, the Kurds in Iraq have now decided they want independence, and indeed there has been a referendum in which 1.7 million Kurds, that must be virtually the whole of the adult population, have petitioned for independence, and the leaders, Barzani and Talabani, say, well, look, the people have spoken, what can we do? This is the will of the people. We are heading for a very dangerous situation, focused on the city of Kirkuk, where the Kurds claim to have a majority, where the Arabs claim to majority, where the Turkmen claim to majority, and where, among other things, the long-term consequences of Saddam's moving of populations will wreak its poisonous consequences. The other country, a third country which claims to be winner, is of course Israel. Israel has long been a supporter of a hard line against what it's termed terrorism, so they have no problem with bin Laden, and they favor hostility to states like Iran and Iraq that appear to support this terrorism. I believe, and I say this with all the knowledge that it's counterfactual, but based on some personal observation of this matter, talking to Palestinians and Israelis since 1967, indeed, that there were three occasions in the last 35 or more years when a possibility of a reasonable two-state solution existed. And I've also no doubt this is the only just and stable solution to the problem, and one which many Palestinians and many Israelis support. The problem is, the sensible people are not always able to carry the day. I'm reminded of the famous remark by Adlai Stevenson, the American Democratic contender, where he was giving a speech and someone said, all thinking Americans are with you. And he says, that's all very, very well, guys, but I need a majority. And I think that sometimes talking to the kind of Palestinians and Israelis we meet here, or you meet at conferences, or indeed when you go to Birzeit or to Tel Aviv University, one has to remember this. But my own view now is that following the breakdown of talks in 2000, and in particular following more recent developments, assassinations, the Sharon plan, and the rise of Hamas among the Palestinians, that all this is past and will not return. There may be truces, there may be negotiations, the quartet will go through their motions, but at the end of the day, it is now a fight to the finish. There will be no compromise, and in the end, there will be no peaceful or separate two-state solution. I regret to say this, because I think the human suffering will be great, the international ramifications will be enormous, and the international outcome will be catastrophic. I don't intend to waste much time now on who is to blame, except to say that in my view, having looked at what was said and done, I think the leadership on both sides has been blinkered and short-sighted, but I would also blame the broader diasporas and support networks of both sides as well. The failure of the Arab and Muslim world to envisage what would be a serious compromise on Palestine, on Jerusalem, on the refugees, and to give backing to it, particularly in 2000, and on the other hand, the role of intransigent and bigoted long-range nationalists in the Jewish community abroad, and of course the neoconservative supporters in Washington. Now, Israel at the moment has the military upper hand, but Israel is a vulnerable society. 20% of the population have committed what's called Yorda, going down literally, as opposed to Aliyah, going up, and have left, and more will leave, and the best and the brightest will go. We don't know how many tens of billions of Israeli money have left the country, and I'm sure a few more have left after the recent vote in the Likud, which I regard as the equivalent of brawling on the decks of the Titanic after it's hit the iceberg. But I think that something very serious has happened, and having long sustained the belief that a peaceful solution was possible, and having been a strong supporter of Oslo, I'm afraid those hopes have now got to be terminated. So much for the immediate consequences. Amidst all the rush of events, it may be difficult to try and look at some of the broader analytic questions raised by this conflict. And yet I think as social scientists, but also as people who are not directly involved in the heat of these issues, it behoves us to do so. Here I want to look at four or five questions, which I think are part of the academic analysis of international relations, both analytic and normative, and which arise out of this conflict. First is a question I suspect everybody has an answer to, but it's actually more difficult to answer than you think, which is why on earth did they do it? Why did America and Britain actually invade Iraq? Now, all sorts of answers get thrown up: weapons of mass destruction, regional security, oil, the obsessions of an inadequate son with regard to his father, Israeli influence in Washington, and all this. But I don't find all this very satisfactory, and one day PhDs will be written, I hope at LSE, and I hope under our colleagues who teach foreign policy analysis, Margot Light, Chris Hill, Christopher Coker, and others, or their successors, as to why it happened. But some obvious points, I think, can be made. First of all, no state, least of all a hegemonic one, acts for a single reason. We're clearly looking for a multi-causal decision. Or as we say in international relations, there are several levels of analysis. I'm not sure how profound it is, but I happen to think it's true. Secondly, it's obvious that several factors did play their role. The Gulf does have two-thirds of the world's oil reserves, and will have a much higher percentage of world supply in coming years. And people in the West celebrate the decline of OPEC to 37% of world output. Well, it's going up to 50-something percent over the next 20 years, particularly because of Chinese demand. And the four or five countries which will control it are Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Abu Dhabi, and they're all there. Moreover, it's evident that the human rights record of the Iraqi regime made it easier to denounce and discredit the Iraqi government. Although I don't think this cut much ice with the armed forces of either the United States or Britain. Recent discussions with some British soldiers, British officers on a training course led me to think they thought very poorly of such reasons, but this certainly helped. There was also a very strong Israeli influence. Israel is a close ally of America, and it influences American policy. One shouldn't be surprised at that. Of the people very close to Bush, Cheney certainly, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, are strongly sympathetic to Israeli and Likudnik views. And Israel pushed the view not only that Iraq should be hit, but that somehow if it was hit, the situation in the region would be improved. It may be that Kerry, if elected, will have a somewhat different view, but on the Palestine question, I don't think he will in practice, and on Iraq it's already too late. But we also have to look at something else, which is kind of obvious, but I find intellectually puzzling, which is this. In talking of the analysis of foreign policy, we talk of states, we talk of structures, we talk of historical influences, and we tend to lose sight of something very old-fashioned, which is a group of individuals, five or six of them in a room, taking major decisions. And yet the more we learn, and the more we learn from this spate of very interesting books which has come out, that seems to be, in considerable degree, what has actually happened. Very striking, in even the most polemical accounts of American foreign policy making, nobody mentions the oil companies, nobody mentions the military-industrial complex, if any of you are old enough to remember what it was supposed to be. Congress plays no role at all. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee is basically off the map and thinks it should play low-key. The press in America, media, doesn't seem to have any influence at all. Did I say political parties? They haven't heard much of them. Basically, it seems, in some extraordinary way, it seems to be Bush with Cheney, Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, Armitage, and then a few second-rank people, who have decided during the 1990s that they were going to do regime change in Iraq, who didn't quite know how to do it because they didn't have enough support till September the 11th. And then when September the 11th happened, the American people were converted to the need to be active, and so they decided to do it. So let's get away from the idea that they decided in March or January 2003. They didn't. They decided from the beginning that they wanted to do it. September the 11th gave them the moment to go ahead, and we know that the CIA and the Pentagon were tasked very soon after that with preparing for this event. Rumsfeld, in one of his characteristic asides, was told after September the 11th that it wasn't anything to do with Iraq or Saddam, it was bin Laden and the Taliban, and he said, why go after the little guy? Well, they did go after the little guy, namely the Taliban, but then they went after the big guy as well. This strikes me as very odd, not just in the context of political science and all our institutional and structural and historical explanations, but also by comparison with the Middle East. When I was doing this book on the international relations of the Middle East, which I found extremely difficult, and I'm never going to do it again, I can tell you that, I had a discussion with an Arab, very old Arab journalist friend of mine, and he said, what are you writing? And I explained to him. And then he said, "Ya professor," he said, how can you write a whole book about foreign policy in the Middle East? There's only one sentence. The leader decides everything. Now, this was very encouraging for me, trying to write an academic textbook. But this is what's happened in Washington, by all accounts. And yet, can this really be true? I throw this out, but I think this issue, this intellectual issue, of which we now know a lot, because we have these Woodward and all these other books, the James Mann book on the Balkans, I recommend to you. It's a wonderful book. This is what seems to be the case. Second academic question is the question of history. Those who analyze the Middle East love to invoke history, as do participants. But this is often a disguise for current interests rather than an exploration of how the past really determines or explains the present. I am forever reminded of James Joyce's observation in Ulysses, which was published 100 years ago, that history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to escape. There are, however, two very obvious ways in which, beyond the modern history of colonial state formation, which Charles Tripp has written about, and the generalizations and study of Arab nationalism and interstate rivalry, history does exert its hold on the present in regard to this matter. On the side of Iraq, no one can understand the mentality and appeal of Saddam Hussein without looking at the society in which he grew up. We do not need, and indeed my view should not, give too much ground to generalizations about the severe or harsh character of Iraqi society and culture as an explanation for the brutality of the Ba'athist regime or of its predecessors. But an essential part of the context of the Ba'ath regime from 1968 to 2003 is the history that formed its leaders. The aftermath of the suppression by British forces of the nationalist 1941 Rashid Ali uprising, the mass mobilizations against the state over the UK's proposed treaty in 1948, and again in 1952, I think possibly the first time the word intifada or uprising was used in modern Arab politics, growing hostility to pro-Western monarchies in the 1950s, and as always the Palestine question, followed by the revolution of 1958. On the revolution of 1958, and in line with my point about the importance of social science and Iraq, I would point out to those of you who have not had the pleasure of encountering the greatest work of social and historical analysis of any modern Middle Eastern country, The Old Social Classes and the Revolutionary Movements of Iraq, by the late Professor Hanna Batatu of the American University of Beirut. And this is a work, a de Tocquevillian work, as the title The Old Social Classes implies, and is a wonderful analysis of modern Iraqi society and its ramifications. And he himself was a very courageous person. We had in 1981 a conference at Exeter on Iraq, and the Ba'athists came, and they sat in the front row. And when Batatu spoke, one of them very slowly drew his finger across his throat. And Batatu looked at him, and he said, I am a free man, and I will not be silenced. And so it was. And to the end, in Beirut and throughout the Arab world, he spoke on. And that memory, for me, as well as this great book, are a testimony to his courage and brilliance. And it's a great pleasure. I'm, in fact, going on Sunday to his department in Beirut to give a lecture, and I shall commend his memory to the students. But that history of nationalism and mobilization and frustrated aspirations lies behind the anger which Saddam expressed, but also which he was able to mobilize, This, together with the confected state-directed use of national heritage, in which all the precedents of modern Iraq, be it the Kurdish anti-crusader Salah ad-Din or the tyrants of ancient Mesopotamia, Hammurabi and Nebuchadnezzar, the latter of whom, of course, conquered Jerusalem and enslaved the Jews in 586 BC, were recruited to legitimate Saddam's rule. But history has also had its hold on the Western side. The senior officials now running Washington, far from being, as they claim, free of the constraints of the Cold War, are in fact prisoners of it. This is above all evident in two respects. First, the overall strategic vision of Bush's advisors, who call themselves the Vulcans, the god of iron and war, far from being some great response to the post-Cold War world, is a rehash of Cold War themes. This outlook, sometimes, and in my view improperly, dignified in IR theory as realism, is evident in the thinking of Rice and Wolfowitz in particular. What no one has told them, or they've chosen not to see, ensconced in their beltway offices, is first of all that this realism was never an accurate account of why the world worked, or how the Cold War happened, let alone why it ended. As many of us during the Cold War, Mary Caldor, Gabriel Kolko, Daniel Ellsberg, Michael Clare, and many others tried helplessly to point out. But also, the world has indeed changed very substantially since 1991, and new opportunities and threats are presented. But most importantly, the salience of military power, particularly strategic, nuclear, and other military power, is far less than it was. And we see this in what's happening in Iraq today. American military power is predominant and will be so for as long as any of us can imagine. It's economic power, and I speculate not on the dollar overhang, I leave that to the director or others, Robert Wade, if he's here, is quite another matter. And the political control of the United States of the world is much less. Where is American hegemony in Europe today, let alone in the rest of the world? I don't want to put too much emphasis on this, but I think in addition to guns and money and state power, there is something else, which is opinion, which matters in politics, be it ideology in a high-flown way or public opinion in a more everyday sense. And if we look at the world today, most people in the world are against America to the extent that they even sympathize, if not with bin Laden, then with the Mujahideen of Fallujah. And this is before the photographs of the torture. Don't call it prisoner abuse. It's torture. Bas. And this shift in public opinion is a very important feature of the world. In a way, it wasn't even at the time of the Cold War. And this is what the Vulcans have not understood. The person who was a great beneficiary of the Cold War itself, and who has been a good student of history with a range, I have to say, longer than that of any of the Vulcans, even though he didn't study at Princeton or LSE, and who has observed very astutely how the world has changed since 1991, is, of course, Mr. Osama bin Laden. In his cave, somewhere in the Hindu Kush, he has shown that he is a much sharper and more perceptive take on international politics than the supposedly visionary occupants of 1800 Pennsylvania Avenue. He has also, as we have seen in recent weeks, understood a lot better the timing and character of European democratic politics. The Washington elite are, moreover, prisoners of the Cold War in another respect, one that goes to the heart of the Iraqi case and the issue of weapons of mass destruction, namely that when unable to mobilize support for their actions in other more legitimate grounds, such as international law or human rights, they resort to a well-worn and far too little challenged ploy, threat inflation. During the latter stages of the Cold War, from the 70s to 1983, and prior to coming to LSE, I myself worked as a researcher for a critical liberal think tank in Washington, the Institute for Policy Studies, run by people who had been dissidents in the Kennedy administration. And Mary Caldor and many others worked with us there, Anthony Bannon. And one of the things we worked on was threat inflation, threat of the inflation of the Soviet military superiority, which was never there, except in the time of the Sputnik for a couple of years, inflation of the strength of Soviet society, which we said was crumbling much more than they claimed it was, and in my case, the inflation of the Soviet role in the Third World when things like the Nicaraguan Revolution or the Iranian Revolution had quite other causes than that of the activities of the KGB. Of course, they didn't take any notice of this, but what we see now is the same people. What I call the stage army of threat inflators are all back. Richard Perle, Rumsfeld, Frank Gaffney, all these people, they're all back talking about time is not on our side. It's a window of opportunity. We have to strike before it's too late. How often did we hear this? Gross exaggerations of the military potential of the other side, as in the days of the Soviet Union. Of course, Saddam was buying bits and pieces. He wasn't an engineer. He wasn't a manager. He was clueless. And people were selling him stuff. He didn't have a nuclear program since the Israelis bombed it in 81. He didn't have a chemical or biological program of any importance since the UN got rid of it in 1995 and his son-in-law defected with all the secrets. He had his fantasies and they replicated them. But the intelligence failure was not about raw data. By the way, there is no such thing as raw data. All data are socially and imaginatively constructed. I don't go as far as Professor Bruno Latour, who once said here in a famous lecture on epistemology that in the paleontological laboratory, the dinosaur is a participant in the experiment. I don't go that far. But the whole investigation now of raw data, what data was there, the integrity of the intelligence process, misses the point that these things are always constructed from the beginning in a proper way. Without that, you couldn't think. Secondly, the intelligence failure wasn't who said what to who, or who doctored which dossier, who nicked what from the internet. It was a failure to think of what was going on in Saddam's mind, which Charles Tripp or Sami Zubaydah or anyone else could have told them over a cup of coffee, but they didn't listen and instead engaged in all this stuff. Thirdly, there is an issue which underlies much of what we are witnessing today, and which is, in my view, the topic that social science and LSE has above all neglected over the past half century, which has slipped, as it were, between the lines of disciplinary division and departmental surveillance, namely violence. After World War II, the topic of violence, like that of nationalism, somehow went off the social science agenda. Yet it combines issues of psychology, of sociology, of politics, and, not to be forgotten, because wages have to be paid to peoples in militia and guerrilla groups, it involves economics. It's a welfare system apart from anything. Even in Ireland or Lebanon, you can see that, particularly when you try and demobilize people. Now, all societies rest, as Weber and Gramsci insisted, on a core of violence. Occasionally, we see this in London, with the barracks dotted all over the city and the statues to colonial mass murderers we seem to like to put up and the flak jackets of our policemen and women. And we live in a city that, let us not forget, has visited its armies on much of the world in modern history and which has been at war in one part of the world or other in every one of the 54 years that the current monarch has ruled. Yet it is the violence of the rebel and of the angry insurgent and of the mujahid that invites particular attention here. And the decision to take up arms, often a much easier one than the decision not to take up arms, and the appeal of violence, particularly to young men, and then the narcotic and intoxifying appeal of violence once it gets going. I'm talking idiomatic terms here because we don't have a social science language. You can't do an MSc on violence, and yet it is a very important and pervasive subject for many of our disciplines. I think most of us who've looked at any particular cases, and I've followed the Irish case from my childhood, are skeptical of people looking for terrorist profiles or terrorist personalities. We take some solace from literature, from Joseph Conrad, among others, but faced with the challenge, the moral, the legal, the psychological challenge which violence poses to our society and to many societies around the world, it's surprising how little we understand it and how little we have sought to understand it. Finally, let me come to one of the ethical and normative issues that lies at the heart of public controversy: the right to intervene and the critique of Western action as imperialist and hegemonic. Much of the debate so far has focused, and I think will go on doing so, on claims about Western weapons of mass destruction. But I have to say, I think this is a waste of time. As we all know, it was empirically false and was in any case highly selective. Because if there was one rogue state that was spreading and may still be spreading weapons of mass destruction around the region, it was not Iraq, but America's good friend and ally, Pakistan. A country which is very much part of what I have written about as the greater West Asian crisis, but is conveniently left off the edge of Bush's greater Middle East initiative. Although the director's distinguished predecessor, Sir Halford Mackinder, who engaged in a famous debate about the geopolitics of West Asia and the Middle East exactly 100 years ago, insisted that this Afghanistan and northern India be included in the greater Middle East. The argument has been made that if they'd wanted to, Bush and Blair could have made a much better case, not based on WMD, but on other legal grounds, namely Iraq's continued defiance of Security Council resolutions, or on more humanitarian grounds, such as Saddam's refusal to implement the provisions with regard to human rights and democracy contained in UN Security Council resolutions after 1991. And again, it's interesting to ask, separate from polemic, but academically, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they make the international legal case or the humanitarian legal case, or even just the human rights case? They may not never be entirely clear, but two arguments suggest themselves to me without much direct evidence. One is that their domestic political advisors, in the case of Bush, Catherine Hughes and Karl Rove, in the case of Blair, I have no idea who, and it doesn't really matter, the argument that public opinion would not support a human rights or legal security argument for going to war with Iraq. And I suspect that in brute terms that's true. Secondly, from what we know from the press, and as I say from some conversations I've recently had with British serving military personnel, the armed forces are extremely reluctant to engage in major do-gooding operations or post-conflict activities after so many inconclusive years in, to cite the British case, Bosnia, Kosovo, northern Iraq, Sierra Leone, and elsewhere. We did not join the army to do this, was what I was very firmly told a few weeks ago. Two further issues concerning intervention may, however, merit a brief mention. One involves the value that I would call solidarity. That is the question of how we relate as citizens of a democratic country and as individuals to oppressive regimes abroad. And I and other people in this room have participated in many years, and above all the Iraqis in this room, have participated for many years in trying to push solidarity with the people of Iraq, entailing support for the overthrow of that regime. Now, whether the Anglo-American attack on Iraq in 2003 realized that solidarity or not is something one can discuss. But in my view, coming back to my first point, which is that the central point of reference, analytic and moral, should be the Iraqi people themselves, it's this issue, the issue of solidarity, which should frame our discussions, not the other important but secondary issues to do with WMD, who said what to who took decisions, and all the rest of it. The other point I would make, and this is a normative one, which I hope will not discomfort my communitarian and postmodernist colleagues too much, if I have any, is that we hear a lot these days about the critique of the Enlightenment and rational values and how people in the world have different values and different customs. And as Michael Walzer would put it, there are these thin international values, which he doesn't think much of, and these thick locally, they seem to love the word embedded, local values. And this argument can be found in all sorts of liberals, like Rorty and Rawls, and also in Samuel Huntington and communitarians. Etzioni, for example, seems to be very keen on these things. I had him here in the theatre not two or three years ago saying all this. This is a fine debate, and I wouldn't want to stop it. We might all be unemployed. But I haven't noticed, perhaps I missed it in 40 years in the Middle East, that this is the way people there think. They don't say, we are Muslims, therefore don't torture us, or we are Muslims, therefore we want self-determination, or we are Muslims, therefore we don't want corrupt governments. They say we're human beings. We have our culture, we have our traditions, we have our needs, but we are human beings and we're entitled the same as everyone else. This is a cheap shot, but I'm going to make it. Do the people who've been tortured in these photographs deserve less or more because they have a different culture? And on what basis are we protesting about it? I don't think culture's got anything to do with it, and I don't think they think culture's got anything to do with it. And if we look even at the political discourses of, say, Ayatollah Khomeini, or if we look at the wonderful work of Dr. Fali Abdeljaber on political analysis and speculation among the Shiites in Iraq, which was a PhD at Birkbeck and now publishes a book, what we see is these people are not thick or thin. They're Iraqis, they're Muslims, they're Shiites, but they're engaging with issues of democracy, human rights, constitutional government, five-year plans, whatever you want. They're engaging with an international discourse and have been for a long time. And I doubt that if we were to send a delegation to talk to the Mujahideen of Fallujah or even to the army of the Mahdi down in Najaf, that they would make much of their cultural particularism. They have their symbols, they have their holy places, but they would say, we want independence, we want dignity, we want respect, same, we want human rights, we want prosperity, we want honest government. And I think that you'll find very little to support, not the abstractions, but the political or theoretical pertinence of what our philosophers are talking about, if you actually go to these places. And here I would say a word in favor of the much maligned Mr. Francis Fukuyama, who in his book on the end of history stressed the importance for peoples all over the world of respect. Not a very precise term, there ain't any website about it, you can't quantify about it, but we know what respect is. And it is the absence of respect, born of centuries of colonialism, which is far too little criticized in this country and elsewhere, and the arrogance that is expressed in everyday banal chauvinism towards immigrants and others, which is expressed in the brutal treatment of prisoners from these countries, and also in the press coverage of many of these issues. It's that arrogance, the absence of respect, which is, I think, the greatest historical legacy of colonialism, and is also something that underlies this growing global divide between the haves and the have-not, with enormous consequences. Let me conclude with one or two policy observations. I am not an advisor to the Labour Party. I'm an advisor to the Labour Party's Foreign Policy Centre, but there are a number of cut-off points which I won't bore you with now, and there is none so deaf. First of all, as far as Iraq is concerned, it should be obvious that the USA has, in a spectacular mismanagement and blundering, destroyed the goodwill it initially enjoyed when it went into Iraq last spring, and is in danger of destroying the indulgence or tolerance of Iraq's neighbors for its presence there. It has at the same time, through its reckless and illegal endorsement of Sharon's projects, alienated and undermined its allies across the region in a way that no previous American administration has ever achieved. The responsibility for this catastrophe lies with the Bush administration itself, a coalition of retreads, zealots, and incompetents, whose errors in this region, as in others such as the environment, world trade, and international law, perhaps also the management of the dollar deficit, will cost us all dear for many a year to come. Washington, with no strategy and no clear line of command in the everyday management of events in Iraq, has forfeited any claim to tolerance or understanding. And the United States will pay, and is paying, a heavy price for these blunders, and in the eyes of many across the world, let us be clear, will deserve to do so. At the same time, the militant armed groups that have arisen in Iraqi cities have no political strategy of their own beyond the assertion of armed force, and on the basis of all we know, do not enjoy the support of the majority of the Iraqi people. And neither Washington nor Fallujah provide the way forward. The only possible way out of this crisis lies through the intervention with authority and decisiveness, and in a matter of weeks, and with the support of the neighboring states, Arab, Turkish, and Iranian, and with the cooperation of sincere and independent Iraqi politicians and technocrats who have the ability and commitment to pursue a transitional strategy. At the moment, there is some formal willingness, reluctant, I think, on the part of Washington to pursue this policy, but the underlying signs are not good. We still get militaristic bluster from Kimmitt, Abu Zaid, and Myers. We're getting stalling rhetoric from Powell and Bush and Rumsfeld. Of course, their speedy response to the torture issues is another case in point. And I have to say, perhaps worst of all, we have the appointment as the next American ambassador to Baghdad of John Negroponte, a man without any first-hand knowledge of the Middle East in his 40 years of foreign service, and with a record of illegal, not to say murderous, associations in Central America, and of course in his time at the UN, a slavish and blinkered apologist for the Sharon project. The UN's views have been made clear in recent days and should be heeded. In particular, I think we should all wish our best to Mr. Lakhdar Brahimi, a man I've known and admired for 30 years and more, but who was an honored guest here at the school some 5 years ago in his capacity as UN representative in Afghanistan. I well remember his visit in 1971 to a newly arrived revolutionary state in North Africa. And when he came back, I said to him, "How did you find them?" He said, "Ils ont niveau intellectuel plutôt modeste," he said. "They're not very smart," I think would be the, and they're still not very smart. In regard to British policy, I would suggest the following to be a minimal set of conditions for further collaboration with the CPA. First of all, a clear line-drawing restatement of the justifications as now understood for remaining in Iraq and assisting in the transition process. WMD will not wash, and the so-called Iraq Survey Group, which is supposed to report on this, is basically being wound down because all the translators and experts have been sent off on security duties. It's based in Qatar. I was recently in Qatar. I asked the British Embassy I could visit it, and they said, "We don't know anything about it at all. Can't help you on this, old boy," they said. I wonder. The link to Gaida is, of course, discredited. The resort to international law is so contested as to be unusual. And LSE is a wonderful thing. Professor Greenwood was legally in favor, and Professor Chinkin is against, and long may this diversity last. The only case now, and I would argue all along, for remaining in Iraq is one of humanitarian support to the Iraqi people, in other words, of solidarity. Secondly, the Americans have to give clear, public, and irrevocable guarantees as to the integrity and authority of the UN role, what Kofi Annan has called the central role of the UN in any future post-30th of June transition. Thirdly, there has to be a clear, public, and authorized White House support that there are clear lines of command in regard to policy in Iraq, in regard to military and political matters. We don't know who Bremer reports to. We don't know whether Bremer talks to Myers. We don't know who took the decisions on Fallujah. We don't know what the private contractors are up to or anything else. The confusions, blundering, and buck-passing of recent weeks and months has to end. Fourthly, in regard to the mistreatment, not as it is euphemistically called prisoner abuse, but torture of Iraqi prisoners and the detention in Afghanistan and elsewhere of thousands of people in undisclosed detention centers, there has to be a clear and immediate break with the equivocation and bluff that has so far marked the American and, needless to say, the British response as well. And here I will say something that I'm sure they will not accept, but it's a precondition for sorting this out. No purely British or American judicial or investigative procedure will command international credibility. that has to be set up calmly and with due regard to international law on these issues, an international tribunal that will examine the charges with regard to the abuse and torture of prisoners and will administer justice accordingly. As I say, there is scant chance that this will take place, but given international public opinion, and given the scale of what has happened, and given the reflex of covering up, which we see every day, nothing less would do. Finally, until and unless there is a clear resolution of these issues and a substantive handover of authority to the UN, in my view, no further British troops should be committed to Iraq. An active contingency attention, properly announced to Parliament and the public, should be given to a plan to withdraw British troops from an operation that, while having the potential to do great benefit to the people of Iraq, has been squandered by arrogance, incompetence, and bluster. And to repeat once again, time is extremely short. As far as we in the LSE and British academic life are concerned, our challenges are, I think, clear. We have a responsibility, as in regard to all issues in public debate and dispute, to provide what we professionally can, however unwelcome or contested this may be. Some clarification of the analytic, normative, some of the moral and legal issues involved, a clear non-reductionist account of how the past has indeed, as opposed to mythically, come to shape the present, a critique of the illusions and propaganda of those involved, be they states or their opponents, an attempt, provisional it must ever be, to explain what has occurred, and not least, the preservation of our own, in the best sense, academic, special patterns and customs, the space for free exchange of people from different countries which exists here without fear of government, without, may I say, factitious and anti-intellectual calls for boycotts of any kind, or piety towards any of the parties involved. This we owe the people of Iraq. We owe our own best traditions as well. Above all, we as suggested at the beginning, on a real interchange with our Iraqi and Middle Eastern colleagues and friends, which is they who will in the end decide the outcome of their current troubles and whose views have, over so many decades and months, been largely, not totally ignored. I would like to say, I'm laying plans for a series of seminars with Iraqi, Arab, and other Middle Eastern colleagues and British colleagues in the year to come, that LSE is open for business with Iraq. And it will be a challenge, as well as, I have no doubt, a pleasure to meet that task in the period ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Fred, brilliant. Let us take a few questions. We are running a little bit late, so I might try to perhaps take three or four comments, and then you might respond, and perhaps we might perhaps we will have to leave it at that for this evening, though this debate will continue. Who would like to begin? And there's microphones, and if you could say who you are, that would be helpful. One directly behind you. We'll start there, and then...
Hi, yeah, my name's Jeremy. One question, how important is al-Sadr, his connections to Iran and Hezbollah? And do those connections mean that there'll be a permanent kind of insurgency as long as US coalition troops, US and coalition troops are in Iraq? And secondly, just briefly, Rabin, Barak, and Sharon, himself, have all, well, Rabin and Barak have advanced Oslo, and Sharon has unilaterally tried to disengage from Palestinian territories. So is your pessimistic view on the outcome of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict not kind of in keeping with the history of the recent Israeli prime ministers?
Thanks. Take a second one there, and the third one is along that road. Yeah.
Just very briefly, how much influence do you think Blair has over Bush?
Hi, I was wondering if you could say something about the implications for the survival of other regimes in the Arab world, because we heard about the implications for the West, let's call it, or for Israel, or for countries to the north or to the east. But what about the survival of other Arab regimes? Will they fall as a result of the chaos at the moment?
Thank you. And one more down here.
Since it looks like all of the members of the existing governing council are going to be thrown out, who do you think is going to emerge as the new leadership of Iraq?
Right. In answer to these questions, I only say Zidu in the Middle East. Alhamdulillah. Let's see where we go. Al-Sadr murdered, he and his friends murdered our very good friend Majid al-Khoi last year in the temple in Najaf. Not because he was crazy, but for a political reason. He wanted to eliminate established and reputable Iraqi Shiite leaders. And it's a great pleasure that Yusuf al-Khoi, who is an alumnus of the school and is here with us this evening, will be joining us for dinner. He represented nothing, but in a very fast-moving situation, we know this from revolutions, we know that people can suddenly emerge. He is expressing the anger of many people. From what we anecdotally know, he's a lot of Sunnis support him as well. But yesterday, a delegation of senior Shiites went to see him in Najaf to persuade him to lay down his arms and to stop this nonsense, which is what it is. Now, whether he agrees or not is another matter. I think that the Iranians will play an important role, and they must choose the time, and maybe this is the time, to tell him that enough is enough. And the Americans, without announcing it, is of course backed off on the sort of, you know, dead or alive policy, the sort of bin Ladenization of him that they were adopting. There are people here who make like-minded calls for support for people's war in Iraq and all that. I don't think the best interests of Iraq will be served by Mr. al-Sadr, but it's a very fluid situation. On the question of Israeli policy, Rabin was who he was a general, but he was also a shrewd person, and I believe, from all I know of him, and I know people who talk to him, that he was sincere in trying to strike a deal. And I was struck by this most visiting one of these settlements. You're not allowed to say settlements anymore. You have to call them housing estates or suburbs, which they are in a way. At Ariel, which is about 15,000 strong, in 1994, the mayor was from Tehran and his secretary was from Dublin, so we sort of got on in an odd sort of way. but they were railing against Rabin because he'd cut the industrial subsidies to their industrial park, and very importantly, he refused to pay for the school teacher. And they said, look, we're 10 miles from Jerusalem. We all live in pre-67 Israel. If we have to get out, we're going to get out. These weren't crazies. They were living in a comfortable subsidized housing estate, basically. But it's a settlement. And that convinced me that he was serious. But then he was shot. And we know what happened since. And again, one has to say, accident, personality, or if we get more formal in the history of LSE's political sociology, the autonomy of politics plays its role. Don't forget Archduke Ferdinand's encounter with the Serbian nationalist. Maybe it wasn't the only reason, but it sparked something in 1914. And the death of Rabin changed that very much. Barak, I think, was sincere, but he was short-sighted. But neither he nor Arafat had the support, the clear support of the diasporas and the backers who could have helped them to a deal. And to my mind, that's more important than who said what to who in Camp David. Not that I trivialize that either. Blair thought he had influence with Bush, particularly on the question of Palestine. Blair is also, heaven forbid, an example of the autonomy of politics. I mean, look at the decision on Europe. One of his former ministers did say to me a few weeks ago, the boy doesn't listen, and I think that has been borne out. My view is, if there is any logic to what he's done, it is that he saw some weeks ago that he was going to go down, and his reputation was going to go down over Iraq. It would discredit him, so he's decided to go down over something which is creditable, and that explains the European decision. But maybe I'm giving too much to the autonomy of politics. But is the attitude of the majority of the British people towards Europe, is it conjunctural, is it Evan Montiel, or is it long durée? I fear it's long durée, but we'll wait and see. As far as the Arab world is concerned, I think there's enormous nervousness in the Arab world, and I'll just mention it at two levels. One is, on top of the Iranian revolution and on top of Afghanistan, the American invasion of Iraq has polarized Sunni Shia sentiment, particularly in the Gulf. If you ask people, people say, look, the Shia are with the invasion and the Sunnis are against. That's basically it. It's not easy to talk about these things, but it is important to talk about them because communities identify in these ways. In Bahrain, a country I knew years ago, there used to be Sunni Shia marriages. There hasn't been one since 1979, since the Iranian Revolution. And this tension is growing, and irresponsible people on both sides, Salafis on the Sunni side, and irresponsible and stubborn Shiites on the other, who abuse human rights arguments, and I use that word carefully, are making things worse. And you can see this in Oman. My God, you can see it from everything we know in Saudi Arabia. And of course, bin Laden is happy. But if I ever met bin Laden, I wouldn't ask him, what do you think of the West? I know what he thinks about the West. I'd ask him what he thinks about Muslim women and what he thinks about Shiites. We know what he thinks, but it would be important to get him to express this. And the second point is the Arab regimes, particularly those who supported Oslo, who stuck their neck above the parapet, and many courageous Arab intellectuals did this, and many people did it in private. I know Arab intellectuals who learned Hebrew, who went to Israel, or who studied it, who asked you questions about it, are genuinely interested in what is this place, and how come they have a democracy, and all this kind of, how can they win wars? But those people have been swamped, and the chance will not come back for a long time. But the governments are all worried. And one Arab ambassador I know, who comes from a country that's closely allied with the United States, said that unless there is a deal in the next few weeks, there is going to be a tornado from Marrakesh to Muscat, which will consume them all. And people are very worried, and they should be worried. And what Mubarak said about how angry he was with the Americans, I think, stands for this. And Bush's decisions were taken with scant concern for the implications in the Arab world. And we people say the Arab world are angry. Of course they're angry. They've been dominated. They've been misunderstood for a long time. But they have long memories. They're not going to go away. They are our neighbors. They've been our neighbors since the 7th century. And we better get it right. And we're not getting it right. When it comes to the Governing Council, I have enormous faith in the depth and variety of intellectuals and politicians in Iraq, despite 35 years of dictatorship. And in one sense, if the current people, the Pashachis and the Zubairis and the others, move aside, there will be others to take their place. And I know, and every Iraqi in the room knows, there are people who've not put their cards on the table, who've remaining in reserve, but who would, at an appropriate time, be willing to serve their country. But they may leave it too late. And if the fires of Fallujah and Jaish Mahdi, of al-Sadr's people, consume everything, these people will have no role. But the Americans have made things impossible for them. They didn't listen to them. They said to them, don't disband the army. The army didn't. Americans said we had a wonderful victory in Iraq. It's because the army didn't fight. The army said, we're not against America. And they couldn't see that. They proceeded to allow some of these crazy militias to develop. They didn't listen to the advice about who to talk to or not. They listened to Shalabi. I've met Shalabi. I was not impressed. And the record of what he did in Jordan is well known. I don't need to go to this here. Bremer knows nothing. He's a nice man, apparently, but he doesn't know anything about Iraq. I was told he went to see Massoud Barzani, the KDP leader in the north. He went into Barzani's office, and there's a huge picture of Mullah Mustafa, the great Barzani, Massoud's father, the great Kurdish leader. And Bremer looked at the picture and said, who's that guy? It's like walking into a British government office, the picture of the Queen, and saying, who's this woman? But this is compounded by the fact that people who know about Iraq, and there aren't that many of them, have been removed from any role in all this. What's the point of sending Negroponte? He doesn't know anything. The same, I have to say, all these people appointed these intelligence committees to review things. None of them know anything about the Middle East. If you haven't studied Saddam and what goes on in his mind and the history of Iraq, you can't possibly assess the intelligence issue. Because the key issue is that, not the integrity of what Tenet or somebody else said to so-and-so, or these guys, Scarlet and all these guys. So yes, there are people who could form a successor council. Lakhdar Brahimi's already got his list. However, if the United States retains security control, if the UN does not have an authorized serious role, it will not be easy. And of course, there are other problems too. Number one, many people in Iraq suspect the UN because of the enormous inefficiency and corruption of the oil for food program, of which the Saddam's oil coupons is part. And secondly, among the Kurds and the Shiites, they say, where was the UN when we were being massacred? Where was the Security Council? They didn't protest. And therefore, there are real issues there. But it seems to me that's the best hope, and we come back to our dear friend, the contingency autonomy of politics. But it may all be consumed. But that the majority of Iraqis wanted to get rid of Saddam, that an opportunity was there, that some opportunity, if we listen and work with the Iraqis, is still there, I think that's the best we can hope for.
Thanks. We ought to stop. In fact, we ought to have stopped. But before we do, I would like to give a very quick opportunity to any of our Iraqi friends who are here, if they would like to say anything. I guess if I were even-handed, I would say Iraqis or members of the Bush administration, but I'm not sure.
Well, perhaps I think one or two Iraq Arab
or
friends
any
would
others,
like to say Nasser, do you want to say anything?
Of our Arab visitors who are here.
Yes, Nasser. Yeah. The ambassador of Qatar, yes. A former student at the school, may I say, although
Well, I think it's very difficult to speak after, you know, after the professor, but I think it's very important that to look at the situation today with a lot of trepidations. If the United Nations is not given a lot of support, and Tawil Akhtar al-Ibrahim is not given a lot of support in the next 3 weeks, and if a map, a road map, is not clear cut out there, I think the whole region will go through a very difficult time. And I think if we look at the what happened in the last, in the last 4 weeks, and what happened in the last 7 days, whereby this tortured Iraqis pictures were shown all over. And when we see in Arab TVs, in every homes, there are now two scenes. Israeli's armies killing Palestinians and American forces killing Iraqis. So every Arab family now look as if they are the ones who are attacked. They say, it could be me. Instead of Iraq, it could be in Syria, it could be in the Gulf, it could be in Yemen, it could be in Morocco. And they look and they say, what is it? For 200 years, we've been invaded. For 200 years, the West been intervening in our affairs. Don't they get tired of it? So I think this is what we have to worry about, because as somebody who lived in the West, studied in the West, I never felt so angry as I am today. Because in one way, nobody is listening to the Arabs, whether Iraqis or others. They are not listening to their politician. They are not listening to their intellectuals. In a way, there is this sense of, we know what is good for you, but you don't know what is good for yourself. Second, the issue of the Palestinians and this continuing violence against the Palestinians created a lot of forces within the Arab societies, where even governments now are frightened. And I tell you, there are those who are saying, in a globalized world, we cannot be the victims. Either we are part of it, or everybody will go down with us. And this is what we have to worry about. And that's why I really pray that Al-Akhdar al-Ibrahim will be given a chance to speak with other Iraqis. And there are a lot of good Iraqis. Iraq has the most sophisticated people in the Arab world. They are the most complex. I mean, Iraq is not Kuwait or Qatar or United Arab Emirates. It's a country with a lot of history, with a lot of complexities. And it is my hope that he can succeed, because if he succeeds, we are all going to succeed.
Thank you.
Yes, I know if any Iraqi, wants to speak, I don't know.
Does any Iraqi wish to catch my eye? If not, I think we probably will wind up. Thank you very much for your attendance, but thank you particularly to Fred for this lecture. It was characteristically brilliant and wide-ranging, and yet ending with some clear policy recommendations. I should point out that professors do not get overtime for delivering these lectures, at least if they used to, they don't anymore. And we're enormously grateful to you for all the work you put in and for a really fascinating, wide-ranging, but also practical speech. Thank you.
Thank you. Well behaved.